Welcome to Destiny. Now here's your host, Cliff Dunning.
Well, I'm off the plane. It's been a little more than 24 hours since I returned from Egypt. And wow, great time. What a great group that we had for the 2022 Grand Egyptian Tour 3. I can't say enough about the people who were with us on the tour from around the different parts of the world. So great to hear from our friends in Australia, New Zealand. Those are two countries that were basically shut down by the pandemic. Representatives from Canada, Germany, Poland. It's always real fun to get together with people that hear the podcast, that are fans of the podcast, and connect. And I connected deeply with a lot of people, but unfortunately, I was in a state of exhaustion. When I left, I had been diagnosed with severe exhaustion, and I wasn't fully present for a lot of the tour. And I have to apologize to my friends who were there. They are probably thinking, what the hell is going on with Cliff, man? He's so quiet and subdued. Well, I was not myself, and I am still recovering. You might hear it in my voice. I have a little hoarseness, but I have been challenged in the last few months, just burning the candle at both ends and trying to do the podcast as well as finish the edits on this new book, Cannabis and Sexual Ecstasy for Men. And so I got there and I was depleted, and I tried as I best, I just couldn't break out of it. And I was kind of tagging along a lot of it. Thank God for Mohammed Imbrium. He is just a joy to be with. And I got to say, if you've been thinking of attending the Earth Ancients annual Grand Egyptian Tour, you should do so because, you know, I'm there to say hello. But Mohammed Imbrium is just a brilliant presenter, teacher, and researcher who's been there since he was a child and understands the details. So, hey, and I have to say this too. I'm going to back up a little bit. Flying 22 hours is a miserable experience. I mean, you're crammed in these aluminum cans and fed droplets of water and food, and it's really a challenge when you get off the plane because you're exhausted, you're cranky, you're hungry, and your rhythm, your timing has been screwed up because you're usually, you know, you're flying from different parts of the country to arrive in Cairo. And my God, you think they would figure out a way to make it easier on you because, you know, it takes a couple of days to recover. And for me, it just added to my misery, you know. And I have to be honest, I just don't travel very well. I just do not get in planes and fly hours and hours. Hey, and I've been flying around the world for 25 years or longer. I used to fly for business, but that was in the United States. I'm in California. I'd fly out of San Francisco. Sometimes we'd, you know, have a conference in I was a trade show manager in the early days. I set up trade shows for software companies. We'd, you know, set up in Florida, New York, Atlanta, all the states. And for some reason, that was a little easier on me. But when you cross the Atlantic or the Pacific to go to one of these ancient sites, it is just devastating on the body and the mind and the spirit. So you had to recalculate, readjust, which usually takes a couple of days. And it makes it difficult. And I just wish they would figure out another way to do it. You know, I don't know. We just have to deal with it. But it just added to my misery. And thankfully, you know, most of the people were excited to be there. I think everybody was excited to be there. And without a doubt, this masterful host from Cairo, Mohammed Imbrium, was there to ensure with his staff. And he had a staff at every place we went to. We weren't at Cairo the whole time. We stayed at Cairo a couple of days and had a tour of the Giza Plateau. Then we got on a plane and flew to Aswan, saw the quarries, saw Elephantine Island, saw Luxor, and then we were on the boat. Oh, I got to tell you, floating on the Nile is, you got to do it. It's like nothing you'll ever imagine. It is so calming. And those boats, those cruise boats, they are decked out. I mean, they're very comfortable. They're opulent. And then they have this spread, man. This food is just to die for. They have chefs there to take care of the food. It's just top of the line. I have upgraded, and I was laughing with Muhammad. If he's listening, you'll know what I'm talking about. We used to call these tours the diplomatic tour, you know, because you were treated like a diplomat from your state, from your country, from wherever. I have upgraded the status to elite. Muhammad Imbrium and the tours he produces are elite tours. They're top of the line. You cannot get any better because he has a staff team member to watch over you, to make sure all your necessities are handled, all your desires are fulfilled. And you're just treated with amazing grace and respect. It is, without a doubt, an elite tour. So, by the way, the name of his company, if you ever want to work with him, is Saba Tours, S-A-B-A Tours, out of Cairo. And just the top of the line. You cannot get any better. And if you're an anomalist like me, Muhammad is an anomalist, flat out. He is all about the subtle energies, the megalithic builders, the prehistoric, the pre-Diluvian people, and he brings it out, and he brings it complete as a scholar. And by the way, we'll have him on in July to talk about the obelisks, and he has a new book coming out that we want to talk to him about as well, which I've seen. He actually presented some aspects of it during the tour. It looks like a real winner, something that a lot of people are going to want to read. So anyhow, great tour. Join us next year, May. It's going to be May again, May 2023. And he's going to hold the price back too. These tours, 12, 13-day tours, are in the $6,000 to $10,000 range or more for a basic tour. What we see, what we experience is an archaeological tour with academics. And that means that we're going to meet with some of the antiquities directors of the Egyptian museums, which we did meet in Saqqara, as well as other places. And we also get private tours with these guys. You can't get that with the general public tours. They just don't go there. The last and the most impressive day, we went underneath the Saqqara Pyramid, amazing, in these tunnels, and I'll talk about those later. And then the cherry on top of the sundae is a private tour that we all took in the Great Pyramid, and that is an opportunity to climb inside the pyramid without the general public, to go to the king's, the queen's chamber, and the subterranean chamber. Yeah, we were in the subterranean chamber for over 2 hours, and that's a mind blower. So you can go to Earth Ancient's Facebook page and see photos of what these chambers look like. So fascinating, great. I wish I was more present. I was as good as I could get, and I was not good. Mentally, I was fatigued. I'm still a little fatigued, but I had a good time, and that was what counts. Hey, I want to remind you, my book came out this week, Cannabis and Sexual Ecstasy for Men. We'll have a program on it here on Destiny in a couple of weeks, but check it out. It's on Amazon. I'm finishing up the Audible version of it. It is the latest and greatest on arousal strains for men and women and an understanding of how ancient Hindus used marijuana, cannabis, to not only further creativity, but also tap into arousal states or sexuality. and to transmute physical, emotional, and mental states into higher realms through orgasms. And I'll talk about that again in a couple of weeks. Having an orgasm is not only very beneficial physically, but we're now learning that psychically, emotionally, spiritually, an orgasm transcends the physical and connects us with our higher realms. That can be your higher self, it can be your spirit guides, it can be your soul, whatever. There's a level of orgasm that is released when you are altered with microdoses of cannabis, and this is what the book is all about. The grand focus is on men's sexuality, men's orgasms, through an understanding of the prostate gland, this master gland that is somewhat, I should say, it always is abused, not purposefully, but it's through our diet, through lack of exercise, and lifestyle. Our lifestyle for men, most men are not aware of their prostate, and this is the master sex gland. It's not the penis, it is the prostate gland. If you take care of your prostate, you stimulate it a little bit, you'd be surprised about the level of sexual release it provides. And would you believe men can have multiple orgasms? And that is the basis of the book. So check it out, Cannabis and Sexual Ecstasy for Men. It will change your understanding, and I will be talking about it in a couple of weeks. So something to consider. Hey, our guest today is a retread. It is Carlton Brown. Our regularly scheduled guest had to cancel. She's in. We've had Ann Gadd before talking about the Enneagram. She'll be back in June. But I pulled up this pretty in-depth interview with Carlton Brown, Sun God's Sacred Secrets, which was recorded in 2014 and outlines his understanding of how meditation and other sacred traditions help us connect with higher realms of consciousness. So, okay, away we go.
My guest today is Carlton Brown, and I'm really happy to have him on the program because he has done some phenomenal research into not just pyramid technology, but the science behind its connection to human, what I think is evolution, and human consciousness. Now, Carlton is a veterinarian, he's a biotech entrepreneur, a vaccine innovator, and he's a hobby archaeologist researcher. His new book, his first book actually, is Sun God Sacred Secrets. And Carlton's quite a fellow. He raised 23 million pounds, which I think that's quite a bit of U.S. dollars. I think that's double. It's 40 million or more. He'll tell us in a minute. To develop a new vaccine solution for mutating viruses and to solve a multi-decade industry technology bottleneck. So basically, he developed universal influenza vaccine able to target all potential pandemic flu strains in a clinical testing environment. He's had a lifetime fascination with pyramid archaeology, cultures, lost civilization, mankind's real history through the Holocene period, and its ultimate effect through altered states of consciousness. Kind of sounds like my interest, too. Sounds like me. It's like I'm looking in the mirror. The fascinating thing about Carlton is that he's actually, and he'll tell us more about this in a second, he's actually traveled the world and been to many of these places that he describes in his book. And he actually currently lives, and he is coming to us today from Guatemala, Lake Atitlan, which is at the heartland of where a number of the ancient Maya lived, and I think there's quite a few that are still there, too. So Welcome to the program, Carlton. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you very much, Cliff. Thank you very much for that lovely welcome. And thank you very much, everyone, joining us on the show today. Really appreciate your presence.
Yes. So tell me about Lake Atlan. Is that high elevation, or where what part of Guatemala is that?
Okay. Yeah, we're at about 1,500 meters. We're right on the, you know, in the middle of the Guatemalan highlands, right over a fault line. You know, I live in a house 60 meters above the lake, 7 kilometers from 4 volcano peaks, and sitting in between those volcano peaks is Santiago de Atitlan, which was the former shaman and priest, Mayan sheep and priest capital of Guatemala. So it was a very important place, and there are a number of these places on the face of the planet, vortexes, you know, and Sedona Vortex in the U.S. is one of them, and Lake Atitlan is also considered one of those as well. So it's a very good place.
Now that's interesting. Sorry. Now you're saying that it's actually, did you pick it because it's on a vortex? Of course, right? Of course. And we're going to learn more about your interest in vortexes. Tell me real quickly, do you have a chance to interact with any of the local native Maya people there at all?
You know, not so much on a day-to-day, although I do know them. I actually live on an old Mayan shaman site, so we've got a cave next door, ceremonial fire, that, you know, only I use these days. But I've certainly met, you know, probably in total sort of half a dozen shamans as I visit various sites around the country. And you get to talk to a lot of the elderly Maya as well. So, you know, from my point of view, they lost a lot of knowledge, but these guys are a real repository of knowledge. And I think you captured some of that earlier on when you talked about meditation and higher states of consciousness and, you know, the things they used to do.
Oh, so you're saying that if you've had any interaction with the current Maya, they don't seem to have an understanding or any link or focal point to currently using the ruins of their ancestors as places for consciousness rising.
You know, I think there are some of them who do, and some of them who very much respect the old ways. I think there are also shamans who go through the process and not necessarily, certainly some of them I've spoken to, not necessarily deliberately accessing altered states of consciousness. So I think, you know, you get quite a mixture. But you go to these sites on a weekend and you'll see ceremonial fires and shamans around for sure.
Okay, well, that's interesting. I haven't been to Guatemala yet, and I'm planning on getting there soon, but I'm always interested to know how the local populations are, how they interact with the ancient ruins of their ancestors and what they do. So just a few questions there. Okay, well, let's talk about this amazing book. The title is Sun God, Sacred Secrets, The Archaeology, Art, and Science of Altered States of Consciousness. Tell me about this book. What was the trigger point for you to delve into this subject of these archaeological wonders, and what made you want to write a book about it?
Sure. No, just very quickly, just to give people some sort of idea, I think the title itself explains very succinctly what the book is about. It's, you know, the archaeology, art, and science of altered states of consciousness, and, you know, this effectively is the doorway into the, you know, the realm of universal consciousness. The book itself is about an archaeological discovery, a shared fingerprint shared by four different sun god religions spanning three continents and more than 5,000 years of human history. And that fingerprint reveals their sacred ritual processes. So, you know, we'll explain this during the discussion. And then what I do with that is really explain the functional significance of those findings in the context of the sciences supporting altered states of consciousness. And, you know, for me, the big surprise was is what we're being told in the art is identical to what science is telling us. So, you know, in terms of how I got into this project, well, I have a childhood interest. I had a father who introduced me to sort of anomalous thinking, if you like, when I was a little boy. And out of curiosity, I was following all sorts of literature I could before I was 10 years of age and really realizing we didn't know the truth. I had a holiday in Egypt in 2008, and bear in mind, you know, prior to 2008, I'd spent probably 5 years of my life traveling around the world, backpacking, adventures, archaeology, although I didn't realize I was going to become an archaeologist. And so I was reading the book Path of the Poles, which, you know, inspired, I think, Graham Hancock's book Fingerprints of the Gods. And, you know, I just asked the question, you know, if, you know, this catastrophe happened, were the pyramids built before or after the catastrophe? So, you know, and you know, it was when I came home, I began that process of, you know, plotting pyramid maps. And, you know, it was then that things jumped out at me. And I think something else happened to me, you know, 1997 when I was here in Guatemala. And, you know, again, at Lake Atitlan, it just grabs hold of you. You know, it grabs hold of you in a what I would say is an indescribable way. And I slept on Pyramid 2 at Tikal as well, and I had a spontaneous altered states of consciousness, you know, an out-of-body experience, and, you know, that kind of left an impact on me. So I think, you know, when you put that all of those things together, when the things started jumping out at me regarding, you know, the observations I was making with the pyramids, you know, that was the catalyst. And, you know, it probably took me about 6 months or so to put the story together in a crude outline. And it was then I realized I had something very unique. And I also, how do we call it? I watched a video a number of years ago by Jiddu Krishnamurti. So he was a recognized spiritual guru from India. And he was talking about the transformation of man. And he asked the question, what's it going to take to transform humankind? And that question, while I was doing this project, just stuck. And I couldn't, no matter what I did, get rid of it. And ultimately, what I did with the book was answer that question. And, you know, what I really want to get across today to, you know, the listeners is, yes, this is a book on archaeology, but I'm a biologist, being a veterinary surgeon and having spent, you know, my career in pharmaceuticals. And I'm taking a biological approach to what is altered states. And therefore, you know, for me, archaeology is it's a means to an end, and I filter a specific filter, which is focused around what are the factors we know that science tells us will lead to changes of consciousness. And so, you know, this is things like silent, you know, places of, you know, silence, meditation, electromagnetic and magnetic, acoustic, and also neurochemicals. So whenever I'm doing archaeology, that's my vista.
Okay, well, let's talk about something that is the foundation of your book, exploring these archaeological finds and the science of the sun as it relates to modulating the human brain. Now, tell us why what you discovered in the sun ceremonies and the sacred focus and what it's doing, what you've discovered it does to the brain.
Sure. Do you want these sort of archaeological findings first, or so people have got an anchor, or do you want me to jump straight into the
Let's do the actual structures and what you've discovered there, and then what you have uncovered in terms of the, if you want to call it, amplification of the sun, or the go ahead and explain what the finds are.
Okay. I think, you know, first off, to the listeners out there, there's a downloadable Google Earth KNZ file on my website, so www.carltonbrownv47.com, and there's 450 pyramids and temples. These pyramids, temple sites that I've looked at have an alignment on one of the solstices, the winter solstice sunrise, summer solstice sunset, or the equinoxes. The equinox most frequently at 50%, solstices at 30%. And the conclusion I draw there is, you know, this is about telling time. It's about telling sacred time. And it just so happens that the solstices and the equinoxes coincide with their most important sacred festivals. So these were the times leaders got together with their priests and they conducted these special rituals in places of sensory silence. So that was the first observation. Then when you dial out from the, you know, looking down at these sites into the regional level, you noticed another very interesting phenomena, and that is that these sites are aligned or clustered, if you like, into lines. And those, you know, so, you know, if we think about the Maya, you know, 900-kilometer line of pyramids, In South America, it's 1,000 kilometers. In southern India, it's nearly 700K. In the Old Kingdom, you know, of Egypt, it's 100 kilometers. But they sit directly under the day-night boundary. So this is the interface between night and day, what we would call dawn and dusk, if you were looking from space on the winter solstice sunrise, the summer solstice sunset. And the significance of that is, you know, we see a sunrise, we see dawn and dusk on the planet, but what's going on overhead is special electromagnetic physics.
So in each of these places you've been to, the complexes are aligned in such a way. Now, would you say that is a science, architectural design that is not random at all, but it has a basis behind it? Obviously, it must have, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, Cliff, I still scratch my head here because, you know, how do you line these sites up so they're within 2 to 7 minutes of this day-night boundary over, you know, big, big distances? How do you do that? So, you know, I don't have a rational answer for that. You know, the key imperative is that they wanted the empires of states to simultaneously experience these enhanced electromagnetic fields. So there was a deliberate intent. And the fact that, you know, you look at the Maya, 70% of their structures are aligned to the winter solstice sunrise. And you look at these temples, you could be at, Calakmul, you could go to Yaksha. You know, these pyramids look alike. So you know there was a common science, a common, you know, architectural design of these sites over the empire.
Mm-hmm. So the interesting thing is that here we go back to Civilization X that kind of left its mark around the world with different ancient cultures, and the Giza pyramids, the Maya, India, maybe even in China, there's alignments like this that is a sacred science. It's a science that we don't know about, and it doesn't make any sense to us today, but obviously it made sense to these megalithic stone builders who built these huge complexes, and there's a lot that we haven't figured out. And but you're beginning to figure out this importance of these alignments, correct?
I think, you know, for me, one of the things I note about this field is it's not very data-driven, and I think, you know, we can critique academia for its lack of different disciplines that it embeds into its, you know, its social sciences, and I think, you know, we've got to look at our own field and realize, you know, we're lacking in data. So one of the things I really wanted to do was I want lots of data points. So, you know, 450 pyramids is pretty significant, 4 different religions. And when you see the same fingerprint, you know, you say, okay, you know, was this random? Well, I think when you see it 4 times, you know, with this level of data, you have to say no. Then you have to say, okay, well, you know, how could that be? And, you know, the reasons I come up with are basically fourfold. You know, one is that there was a common priesthood logic. In other words, this was common sense to them. Not necessarily from our perspective, but from a priest or shaman's perspective. The other is that they were communicating with each other non-locally in altered states of consciousness. I think the third, and this is the thing that, you know, a lot of people in the field have said before, and I'm a believer in, is that there was a precursor civilization that seeded culture throughout the world. And then, of course, fourth, we've got the ET solution. And, you know, I have to, you know, put it on the record. I'm not a fan of ET solutions like yourself.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Carlton, be careful now. Be careful. We don't want to promote that.
No. I was going to say, you know, I think we've got to keep an open mind about ET, but not from a physical point of view. I think from accessing alien UFO experiences and altered states of consciousness. This is described by transpersonal psychologists who've been working in this field for 30, 40 years. So I think there is something potentially there.
Okay. Well, that's another program, but
exactly.
But let me go back to something you just said, which I think is interesting. And I've had kind of an intuition about it too. Is you said one of the points that you had discovered, or what you think about in your hypothesis, is that there were shaman or priests that were communicating among each other in the different cities through kind of like not necessarily telepathy, but they were communicating in altered states of consciousness. Yes. Now, explain that a little bit for us. Okay. What does that mean?
Sure. So, the transpersonal psychology field, and we look at some of the work that, say, Stanislav Grof has done. He describes this capability when we're in altered states. So this is outside of, or we've transcended normal reality. So, again, what I've said is I work back from the biology, and the biology says humans have four states of consciousness: awake, asleep, dreaming, and altered states. And, you know, we've evolved a whole clinical science on altered states over the last 40 years with the birth of the transpersonal psychology field. So guys like Stanislav Grof, who are one of the pioneers of this field, have spent 50 years treating people with things like LSD and holotropic breathing therapy. And they've really categorized and defined the types of phenomena and experiences that are possible. And so this form of non-local communication outside of the body, you know, you're outside of your ego, outside of body, outside of space and time, it's possible to join, if one has the right intentions, join communications and awareness with other people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's good.
So that's the basis of it. And you know, you have to answer the question: why was it important for all of these sites to simultaneously experience these enhanced electromagnetic fields at the same time as they carried out and conducted their sacred rituals? That's the question I've got.
Okay. So this is good because. I've mentioned at the beginning of the program, and we've already talked about it many times, the work of John Burke, the telluric fields, mm-hmm. the geomagnetic fields bubbling up through the ground, and someone from each of these cultures being sensitive enough to know that if they build a pyramid, if they build a structure with magnetic rock, with special cut and formed stones, that these fields are going to be greatly enhanced. And then in your case, you are focusing on the biological point of view, which is what the impact of those fields are on the human brain and body. Go ahead.
I think we probably need to clarify. I think, you know, what we do, we're talking about a fingerprint. So we're talking about an alignment fingerprint and the importance of the solstices and the equinoxes. There's another part to this, this fingerprint, if you like, which is the ritual processes. And it's quite a big topic. But I think if we park that and we come back to it, we can dive into the discussion here that we're having. And so the really important thing about the solstices and the equinoxes is twofold. You know, the solstices generate these enhanced electromagnetic fields in our overhead environments. They permeate everywhere. And they're the sort of frequencies that they use for submarine communication, that the U.S. government's HEART program are using to transmit, electromagnetic waves around the world. And it just so happens, when you look at the biology, that these fields interact with the human body. And, you know, they do a number of things. You know, Schumann resonances can, enhance reaction speeds, or if they're at very low levels, they can slow down reaction speeds. So we biologically respond to them. I think in Teotihuacan, high in magnetic rock, volcanic rock, and therefore their places of high magnetic energy, you know, if you look at the rest of the Maya built on the chalk, limestone Yucatan Peninsula, I wouldn't associate that it necessarily in itself with high magnetic fields. But you've got to remember, this Earth is a magnet. We're bathed in magnetic fields, and there are hot spots over the face of the planet. And it just so happens that on the equinox, these magnetic fields peak in strength, or when we have solar flares, you know, and we're at the top of the solar cycle, this enhanced magnetic activity interacts with the biology of the human being. And so, you know, when you look at Schumann resonances and magnetic fields, they have one thing in common, and that is they passively supplement or enhance human alpha brainwaves. And those human alpha brain waves are what we produce when we meditate in sensory silence, and they're what we generate in very high power when we transcend into altered states of consciousness. And the interesting thing is the science shows us they are supplementable. So this is why, you know, this is why you see these religious festivals timed on the winter solstice sunrise, because that's one of the peaks of the year, and it's timed on the summer solstice sunset, another peak time of the year. And then, you know, why we have the equinox festivals on the, you know, they're associated with the equinox, because we have peaks in magnetic activity. And so, you know, these guys, I've no idea how they figured it out over thousands, tens of thousands of years, but they figured out there were times of the year beneficial to conducting these rituals, and when they combined the meditation and the places of sensory silence together with hallucinogens, they were able to trip into altered states, and that was the basis of their religions. Okay. So, you know, these priesthoods were pretty smart people in my mind.
Yes. I think they inherited quite a bit of their knowledge, though. But let's touch base before we go forward. I want you to, and you've explained and you've used the term archaeological fingerprint. can you tell our audience, is there a similarity in the ancient complexes in Giza and in the Yucatan Peninsula with various Mayan locations? And I guess India and China, what is the unique, I mean, you talked a little bit about it. It's not only the alignment of these complexes as they are positioned to gain not only the perfect sight lines for the cosmos, for observing the planets and the star systems, but the benefits of picking up Earth energies, telluric energies, and things like that. Talk a little bit about that real quickly. Oh, it's not really a quick subject, but kind of give it a highlight, because this is a big point in your book, and it's important to discuss.
The key thing for me is, you know, what we've done is we've talked about alignments, and alignments tell time. And they tell us, you know, these are times of enhanced, you know, energy fields, if you like. And, you know, the other component of that is, of course, all of these sun god religions were housed in lightning centers along the same longitude as lightning centers. And lightning centers are big generators of these electromagnetic waves, these Schumann resonances. So, you know, they understood the biological impact of that. But the most important part of this fingerprint that the different civilizations share in common is that they embedded their ritual processes in deity, art, and icons associated with these sun god temples and pyramids. So, you know, when we look at Egypt, for example, you know, we see these pharaohs' busts, you know, these heads with these Mimes cloths, you know, this 47-degree angle. And we see the serpent in their forehead. We can, you know, this is delineating sacred time. That 47 degrees is effectively the difference in angle between the Earth's north-south axis, one solstice to the next, the summer to the winter. Mm. And so, you know, what I found amongst all of these religions was this symbolism of sacred time, which was the 47-degree angles in terms of outlines of their deities or their, you know, parts of their leader. They put the serpent, you know, in between these solstice extremes, and the serpent is the equinox symbol. So you see this in terms of pharaohs' heads. You see this in Uxmal. You've been there yourself on the east side of the nunnery quadrangle there. You've got these V-shaped angles with Kukulcan's head in the middle. So, you know, this is effectively the pharaoh's head turned upside down. You then go to South America in the Chavín culture in Chavín de Junta. You've got the Raymond de Stella. So you've got this ugly-looking serpent deity standing there holding two cactus staffs. And there are these 47-degree angle layers of electromagnetic coils and three serpent heads. So, you know, you see that at the beginning of the pre-Inca. You come to Viracocha on the gateway of the sun at Tiwanaku. And, you know, Viracocha was the guy who evolved out of all of these precursor pre-Incan deities, these, you know, rayed head and staff deities. And, you know, he's littered with this 47-degree symbolism, serpent symbolism, and, you know, an Adamantathena columbrina, you know, the DMT hallucinogen. So what these guys all did, you see it in India as well, is they embedded three things together. It was always the deity and or the leader in conjunction with sacred time symbols, in conjunction with entheogens or hallucinogens, these neurochemicals. And that's the, I call it the triadic fingerprint common to these four different sun god religions.
Now, have you used a magnometer or any sensing devices at any of these locations to see if you could have actually measurable fields?
Not yet. No, I'm. How do we call it? I'm a poor archaeologist. So the thing that I do, Cliff, is I use the field of science. I look at geology, and you'd be surprised what data's been accumulated in other fields of science.
Okay, like what? When you say that, I mean, well, in terms of measure, we're talking about measuring telluric geomagnetic fields in these sacred locations. That's what I'm just interested in hearing.
Yeah,
about.
Look, I've not specifically measured or associated magnetic fields with these sites. That's not my field of science. What I've done is I've said that the Earth is a magnet. It's bathed in magnetic fields. That's a function of the structure of having a molten iron core and interacting with the sun. So wherever you are on the face of the planet, you experience these magnetic fields. And it's just that there are areas where there are hot spots. And so you go into the geology and you say, what is the rock type here? You know, is it granite? Is it limestone? Is it volcanic rock? So wherever you see fault lines, wherever you see, iron-containing rock, you know the magnetic fields are going to be strong. Around the poles, we know the magnetic fields are strong. You know, as I say, Sedona Vortex, we know that there. But have I got, you know, specifically measured this? No. And that's not, if you like, part of this particular project.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's more on a technical side. Now, you, in some ways, maybe you have, though, because you have actually sat and meditated and had the actual sensation, physical sensation at a number of these places. So, and I think, I believe you write a little bit about that. Let's talk about the altered states of consciousness and what you believe was the one of the main purposes of some of these complexes.
Yeah, sure. I mean, for me, when you look at these places, you know, first off, they were places where religion was conducted. They were the epicenters of their societies. And the thing that, you know, all of these pyramids share in common is they were places of sensory silence. So, you know, the Maya built these massively thick walls that allowed them to basically get away from the noise of the jungle and the noise of their societies. In Egypt, you see a lot of underground chambers or tunnels under pyramids. Some of them you will see, you know, chambers in the pyramids. So they built these, you know, ultimately we evolved from, you know, being in caves where, you know, shamans and Maya conducted their ritual ceremonies. We then got into digging tunnels underground, and you mentioned this at the beginning of the show, under the Pyramid of the Serpent at Teotihuacan. We then moved to pyramid chambers and, you know, chambers and tunnels underneath pyramids. And then, given the cost of building these things, we then moved to temple structures. So we built these temples with outer structures and then inner temple sanctums. And the thing they share in common is sensory isolation or sensory silence. And, you know, as you also mentioned, you know, these were places where they meditated. So it is the silence and the meditation. We know that, you know, that's the gateway process. We access consciousness. It's not something we dial into externally. It's something that isn't driving our entire existence, but we're blind to it. And so, you know, what these guys realized is that, you know, meditation was discovered thousands of years ago as a process that was useful for helping access consciousness. And, you know, it could be made, you know, it could be augmented or it could be supplemented with neurochemicals, with, you know, solstice and equinox, you know, times of the year. And, you know, ultimately it's around a gateway. You know, we're awake right now. you know, tonight we'll be asleep. And, you know, so there's particular things going on inside our body that allow those physiologies and those activities to happen. And the whole idea behind these meditating in sensory silence, doing that at sacred time, taking neurochemicals, is it gave us all the ingredients, what I would call the access codes to switching consciousness.
We're going to take a short break here, and we'll return shortly with our guest today, Carlton Brown. We're speaking to Carlton Brown, who's written a book called Sun God's Sacred Secrets, where he has developed the theory that these temples and other structures lend themselves to enhanced consciousness.
In your research, you talk about the different layers of consciousness, states, altered states of consciousness. Do you find that the buildings by themselves greatly enhance altered consciousness, or is it just certain types of points of the year, like the equinox and the solstices and things like that?
You know, I mean, look, it's a good question, and the difficulty is, you know, no one ever lets you into these places by yourself. I've meditated, you know, I've probably spent in total, you know, 2 or 3 days meditating in the King's Chamber or under the Pyramid of Khafre. You know, I just go in there for 2 or 3 hours at a time. And, you know, it's possible to get to an incredibly deep state, and you feel the resonances of, you know, the sounds of tourists, certainly in the King's Chamber. You know, my view is yes, you know, this is, you know, Giza for me was a machine. And, you know, I posted something on this week, you know, on your site and a number of other sites. A little bit of a side topic. But I, you know, for me, I can, you know, and I've reverse engineered this ritual process, and I use this myself now to access altered states. And you know, like we were discussing the other day, if I just simply meditate, I cannot access altered states. If I were to take hallucinogens just by themselves, keep my eyes open, I'm not going to transcend. But if I combine eyes closed meditation, I've got my body aligned to Earth's magnetic axis, and I'm doing this at sacred time, I transcend nearly every time. Yeah? And so, you know, for me, I have, you know, these are the most mind-blowing experiences you will ever have in your life. Your life will never be the same again. And this is the thing that's been hidden from us by monotheistic religions. They took away from us our knowledge and our understanding that we have a fourth state of consciousness. And they kept it for themselves effectively. And all I've done is to find this know-how, find this knowledge, put it in the public domain. And my job now is to teach people and help people utilize this so they can access consciousness themselves without having to give away their power to other people.
Okay, well, let's talk about these altered states of consciousness. How does one access altered states of consciousness? And more to the point, what is the fourth level, and what is the importance of that high level of fourth level consciousness, the altered states?
Sure. Look, you know, I think at a high level, just to put some, you know, some clarity, put some definition there for people listening in, because this is, how do we call it? It's a kind of a difficult concept to understand. But if you imagine right now, you know, altered states, it's a state of consciousness very different from the awakened state. You're still very alert, still, you know, your mind is very aware of what's going on. But what happens is you've transcended your identity. So in other words, your ego-based mind, the subject object reality that we manifest in day-to-day life, you can transcend your body, so you're outside of your body. You transcend time, space, and your sensory boundaries. And, you know, if you could imagine having the clarity of your mind but without the baggage of your body or the baggage of the life you have, then a number of phenomena happen. And those phenomena are either experienced within or beyond objective reality. And what I mean by that, for example, is we can experience time expansion. So, for example, we could go back to being a baby in our mother's womb. We could go back to being a baby in the birth canal. And it's these two areas that some humans suffer major pathologies. And, you know, that's where Stanislav Grof comes in. People will experience prior incarnations and other lives. You know, I've had that experience myself. You know, where or you will go back into your deep ancestry. You know, it could be way back to when we were, you know, monkeys and trees. We will get an understanding of our evolutionary memory, and it's possible to time travel as well.
Excuse me for a minute, let me just interrupt. Is this state of consciousness controllable, or is it random when you go into that state? Can you actually control what you're doing?
I think you know, that's a very good question, and I can't fully answer that. I think, you know, a guy like Terence McKenna most certainly could, because he had a lot of experience. but what I would say is, what you've got to do is you've got to let go. You can't grab things. When this vista's flying at you in terms of, you know, this is the thing, your eyes are closed, it's like having a TV screen in front of you. And so if you try to grab onto this stuff as it's flying by, you know, it disappears from you. So meditation teaches you to let go and be in the now. So, you know, you can navigate it, you can have some degree of control, but I think the intention you go in with beforehand is fundamentally important. So it's important to state your intentions. Why do you want to do this? And, you know, for me, it's not about I want to go and see aliens or UFOs. It's around healing. You know, first and foremost is we're all, you know, humans are dysfunctional by the very virtue of the lives that we lead. And it's possible to spiritually heal and open up all of our energy channels and use that to help us consciously evolve and personally mature.
The Maya have these phenomenal calculations that go back into early history, thousands of years ago, and how they calculated that is not known. So you bring up an interesting question. Maybe they, in their ceremonies, they actually consciously went back to those early periods and experienced them, and then actually left that information on their stela, their standing stones.
I think you hit the nail on the head there, Cliff. We think science is the only way to evolve or devolve information and knowledge today, but I think they access knowledge from the collective consciousness, and they do this using altered states. So, you know, I think the Mayan calendar is an interesting topic of discussion in its own right, but to focus it, I think, you know, this is what happens. I've been the recipient of this sort of knowledge. You know, that's helped raise my awareness, which has directed my efforts. So, you know, I totally know this can happen.
Can you explain what the process is to go into this state of consciousness? I mean, obviously, you need to have, or would you say that a person needs to be a meditator to do it, or can they just close their eyes and access this?
You know, I think, you know, it's fundamentally very difficult. I think if it was easy, we would have much more examples of mystic avatars like Jesus and Buddha and those sorts of, you know, advanced human beings, and we don't. Mm-hmm. And even when you look at today's meditation movement, we had this discussion the other day. It's incredibly difficult, you know, to transcend while you meditate. And I know, you know, people here who've been doing this for 40 years, and they've only transcended 10 times. You know, I'm not far off that myself, based on 18 months of experiences using this ritual process. So, you know, I tonight start my preparations for the equinox new moon ceremony next Wednesday, and I will fast for 3 days. So, you know, when you look through the ancient, you know, the cosmo-mythologies and things and through the literature, you know, fasting was a, you know, a very important part. This was also an incredibly sacred process. So it wasn't a social, recreational set and setting and have a couple of beers and a joint and, you know, Bob's your uncle, you know, I fly off into the stars. They took this incredibly seriously and it underpinned their religion. So, you know, the sort of thing I do, I will step up my meditation to 2 hours a day, an hour in the morning at sunrise and sunset. I will have short bursts of meditation during the day. I'm in amongst nature. I'm, reconnecting with nature and developing my awe of that, because when we do that, we weaken the ego mind. I will conduct a fire ceremony, invocation, and then I will get up at circa 4 o'clock next Wednesday morning. And I will take a pile of magic mushrooms that I've grown and prepared. And I've got a special spot in the cupboard. There are really, really thick concrete walls, so it's incredibly silent. And I point my chair at magnetic south to these volcanoes, and I start my meditation. And, you know, I lose track of time when I meditate anyway. But as soon as these mushrooms and the meditation and the silence, you know, it starts to kick in after 15 minutes, I'm off. I'm gone. You know, my body has disappeared. My mind is free. It's liberated. And, you know, you can have these experiences, the most mind-blowing bliss, love, consciousness experiences where you merge with, you know, with the Maker. We'll call it divine consciousness, with God, with Buddha. And you have this, you know, realization that you are God and God is you. And, it is the very fabric of your life. It drives everything that manifests in our life.
That's very interesting, but you're right, it's much more complex than just closing your eyes and counting backwards.
It's quite a bit more. Well, it's taking meditation to the next level. You know, these guys in the ancient world were all meditating, and they were doing it in these places of sensory science. So we all must really, you know, from my point of view, we should ideally be practicing meditation in between the solstices and the equinoxes. You know, you could take high doses of shrooms or high doses of LSD, and, you know, you can read the stuff on Shroomery or Arrowhead, and, you know, people have these profound experiences anyway without doing what I'm doing. But the point is that, you know, and that's more mystical or shamanic, you know, if you like. And there's nothing wrong with that. And I think a small percentage of those people, you know, they transform their lives as well. But, you know, what I'm talking about here is a process that was developed with a high efficacy. It delivers altered states of consciousness. And, you know, it does it at particular times of year.
Don't you think that these pyramids or these other structures that were built over these geomagnetic fields were also designed for the different levels of consciousness? So in other words, if someone wasn't able to transcend into the fourth state, as you call it, they still were getting bathed in this energy and having an altered state of consciousness. And let me give you an example. In 1995, I first went to Cancun with a girlfriend, and it was my first opportunity to go to Chichen Itza. And at that time, you could climb to the top of the pyramid, El Castillo. And my girlfriend had an experience that she definitely had she was on some kind of a psychotropic drug. But what was even more interesting is an hour later, she started menstruating. Having her period, and she had already had, you know, she told me, it's like, this is very odd, we need to go to the drugstore. But I'll never forget that, because she was experiencing, and I distinctly remember being bathed in some kind of a vibration when I was in that the top of that pyramid. So my question to you is, do you think that the various chambers and various outlets in these sacred sites were made for perhaps the common man also, not just the priests and the seers of these ancient people?
Okay, I think there's two questions in there, and I'm gonna take your first one. The simple answer is I do believe that there are phenomena that are experienced in and around these structures that we don't and I don't really understand. And I mentioned to you earlier on, I've experienced altered states of consciousness on Tikal, and I had no hallucinogens or meditation inside me. So I kind of almost sunk into the top of the temple, and my body disappeared, and I had this most fantastic experience that at the time I didn't really have the language to describe. So I agree, things happen, and I also accept the fact that I'm only talking part of the story. I think there are other physics there, other scientific paradigms we don't yet understand, and they could be torsion field physics, for example, or as you say, telluric. You may very well be right, but what I do, Cliff, here is I come back to the biology, and I come back to what do we know, what does the science tell us is possible with the human body around consciousness, around tweaking it, and therefore I say, well, what are the levers that we know of? And again, it's possible there's a lot we don't know. But, the simple answer is I think we've got to keep an open mind. And I think, there's enough people around on the face of the planet saying they're having these incredible experiences, these sites. And I think we have to accept, that is infinitely possible.
Do you, as a scientist and looking at it from biology, do you think that the ancients had a understanding of physiology that we don't? As an example, the pineal gland is considered the sacred or the spiritual gland because it produces hormones and other secretions that we're not really familiar with. But those secretions have been noted for the ability to change consciousness. Do you think that perhaps the ancients not only knew that, but maybe were of a different makeup? And specifically, this comes back to a subject that's very open for a lot of discussion, which is these amazingly large-headed individuals who didn't have binding, but had perhaps brains that were 30 to 40% bigger, which means that maybe the pineal gland in these individuals was significantly bigger, so that their altered states maybe came to them much quicker, much easier, and they were of a different biology than we are today. That's kind of a complex question, but I think you got the basis of what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Look, I think we said this before, is that they, in altered states of consciousness, they access knowledge and information. They had spirit guides who taught them and instructed them. How do you know how to prepare the ayahuasca, and mixture? It's a complex of two, and you have to go through a very complex process. How would you evolve that without some prior knowledge? And they got that knowledge from the spirit beings that they met in altered states. So I think the priesthoods were incredibly adept at accumulating this knowledge, and the sciences and things like that were revealed to them through altered states. I think as well, you look at who we are today. We've not genetically changed in tens of thousands of years. So we are the same people today as we were 5,000 years ago. So why wouldn't there be parts of those society who are incredibly smart? And so, there were scientists and clever people, clever engineers, scientifically curious people. There were autistic people with special rare gifts. And, of course these things, this knowledge and insight was part. It's just our 21st century arrogance that and the pedestal we sit on, thinking that we're at the pinnacle of, societal evolution, and we're not.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I believe that totally is possible. So you have a second part to that.
Yeah, and the second part is, do you get a sense? I mean, I remember there was a movie one time, and I can't remember the name of it, where Earth space people went to another planet, and they found alien technology. And one of the technology devices was to transmit knowledge and higher consciousness into the user of this apparatus. And when the humans put it on, it was so powerful, it either would kill you, or if you had the physiology to hold it strong or to deal with it, you had some information passed to you. And I guess my question to you is, do you get a sense that these ancient ruins may have been built by superior beings? In other words, you're talking about, well, we haven't changed in the last 10, 20,000 years, but if these originating beings, earth beings, were of a different physiology, would they have been the ones who would have built these sites and have left powerful energy emitting devices to change consciousness?
Yeah, as long as we're not talking aliens, because I...
No, we're not.
I don't no. Oh, good. Yes. If you show me evidence, hard evidence, I can see with my own, two eyes and discern, then that's a different story. But I think, were there examples of, freaks, if you like, of human evolution that had other capabilities and capacities, and it was easier to act, that could very well be. We see these skull structures with elongated skulls, and was that part of a man-made process of wrapping the skull, or the next genetic variants that could have spawned a new species? That's possible. And I think, for me, we've got to give credit to our ancestors. And our ancestors were a heterogeneous mix of different intelligences and, different stages of evolution. And these were the guys who were solving problems in their own time, building these advanced structures. And, I think by and large, most of these were just places of sensory silence. They gave, in the Maya, it gave them access to visibility to see time over the jungle. So they built these structures, above the tree line. But I think places like Giza, its interrelationships with the other pyramids, particularly Teotihuacan and Xi'an in China, I think they were part of a global geoengineering, project. And, therefore, because when you look at the posting that I made on your site this week and other sites, we're looking at mathematical interrelationships, sine wave metric interrelationships, Earth circumference interrelationships that defy chance. And it says that we were doing incredible things. We had a grasp of science and technology. And, just come to the basic observation. Why do you think the world's biggest Egyptology departments today are the Americans, the Germans, and the British? Yeah, have you thought about that for a moment?
I haven't, but of course, those are the three countries that are there's a lot of cerebral processing through engineering, mathematics. Americans are always thought of to be the epicenter for the new sciences a lot of times, and of course, the Germans have always been quite great scientists, and the British also. So that's what I would think. If there's another aspect, then I'm not capturing it.
Yeah, I mean, so the link is World War II. And, I know this was sort of, popularized in Indiana Jones, but the fact remains is all of these countries were very much focused on ancient Egypt. And, today they have these, rather large legacy Egyptology departments. And, I think, part of the war effort, it wasn't just innovating with the science that we had and the frontiers of it, but it was also being very lateral in our thinking and looking to the ancient world for a source of technological competitive advantage. So, when I always looked at Giza, very, very much like Chris Dunn, I went to Giza saying, given your broader interrelationships and the implied electromagnetic field physics, I'm coming to you to look at the possibility of you being a machine that generated electromagnetic waves. And, the vetinae, anatomy is the structure of function, physiology, the function of structure, I ripped it apart. And I looked at it in the way Chris did. I think, you know, he did a fantastic job with his research there. And I came to the same conclusion. This is a machine. It was a lightning generator generating these Schumann resonances. So instead of having to wait for the solstices or the equinoxes, they could switch it on whenever they wanted.
It's amazing. So much to talk about, not enough time, unfortunately. Is there something you would like to leave us with, Carlton, in the last few minutes of our talk here that you find is the real basis for reading your book, Sun God, Sacred Secrets? What is the motivation for someone to go out and get your book?
Okay, sure. Look, I think twofold. You know, if you're really interested in how do we call it, novel, innovative, data-driven, science-driven answers to the ancient world, then you need to read this book. No one has written a book like this before. I think as well, the second big reason is, for me, this was a treasure hunt. I went looking for treasures, and my treasures weren't gold or lost civilizations. They were the secrets to accessing consciousness. And I've reverse engineered this ritual process, and it's the final chapter of the book. So that's the key for the book, if you're interested in understanding this. And then, I would encourage, check up on my website, www.carltonbrownv47.com, and also join my blog. Because that blog will evolve this discussion on how we utilize these rituals to access altered states of consciousness. And this is something everyone can do within this lifetime. You don't need permission, and it's a very predictable, I believe, a safe process as long as you treat it in a healthy, respectful manner.
Okay. And I checked recently, and Sun God Secrets is on Amazon, but is there any place else? I guess you can get it on your website, can't you? You can get it on your website.
Amazon, the iTunes, iTunes Connect, the iTunes bookstore, and it's also on Barnes and Noble as well. Books.
Right.
So those are the three main ones. And there is a version on Kobo, but I need to re-edit that. But I think for the best variant or best copy, it's on Amazon, and I will, within the next month, launch a hard copy book as well.
Okay, and how many pages is it approximately?
432.
Okay, and I want to let the audience know that
I was going to say, it's simplified science. There's over 300 pictures and images in it. So, a picture's worth 1,000 words, and it's, but it is a book of science. There's quite a bit of data there, and it's about how you access altered states of consciousness.
And in its current state, I would like to let everyone know that it's a digital book. It's an e-book, and it is formatted for Kindle, and it's quite reasonable. It's $10. And for 422-page book, that's quite a deal, I'm sorry, happy to say. So we're in luck until Carlton decides to print, publish a hard copy, and then I'm sure it'll be three times the cost. So get the e-version now. Of course, you don't want to hear that.
Indeed. Look, we face certain constraints with Amazon. So, $10 for the book is the price at where it sits. I think it is good value for money considering the knowledge you get. The paperback will be about $25. It'll be in black and white as well.
Okay, excellent. The book is Sun God, Sacred Secrets, The Archaeology, Art, and Science of Altered States of Consciousness. The author is Carlton Brown. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and I am going to post this link to this audio, but also, as usual, we have notes from our conversation with Carlton, which will be on our the Facebook page, and I will take a couple of the sections of photographs, maybe three or four, from our discussion today from the book to kind of give you a sense of what you can get when you purchase this book and the contents. So thank you very much, Carlton. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much as well, Cliff, and thank you very much to the listeners out there for attending today. Greatly appreciate it.
That was a really sketchy recording. That it was in 2014. He was in Guatemala It was a Skype call, and that's before we had Zoom and these other technologies that can correct the frequency modulation and actually make the call sound better. I mean, we were overlapping each other on some levels, and it made a bit of a challenge. I was thinking about this interview, and I frankly don't agree with him simply because of my own personal experience with some of these temples that I've been going to for 25 plus years. And he's talking about taking mushrooms. This is something that Graham Hancock talks about and other authors talk about. If you're not into taking those, I think you can still get a significant experience or have a significant experience when you go to these temples. I've meditated in temples in the jungles of Yucatan and other parts of Central America, Central Mexico, I should say, and have had significant results. Also, I think it helps to acknowledge these places, and we use intention now to intend to have a experience, to intend to have the sights open to an experience, and you can have really, I've had really, really deep meditative experiences by just asking permission. Now, I do agree with him. If you have a little cannabis, if you are okay with peyote, mushrooms, DMT, obviously ayahuasca, you're going to ramp up the whole experience. And you're going to ramp it up to the effect where you're beginning to work with altered states and really bring in other dimensions. But if you're not into that, if you're not into using psychotropic psychedelics, you don't have to. So that's one of my disagreements with Carlton on this interview. So there you go. I hope you enjoyed that. And I have to find out what Carlton's up to. That book now is that digital version is now a full book, and you can get it on Amazon. And he has, actually researched some very interesting places, not only of the Maya world, but also in other parts of the planet. So do check that out. Hey, we got Mexico coming up. The annual Earth Ancients Mexico tour is Labor Day week, which is September 2nd through the 12th. We're going to meet in Central Mexico. We'll meet in Mexico City. We'll do a short hello, how are ya, do an integration, and then we'll go to a few Aztec sites while we're in Central Mexico. And the most beautiful archaeological museum in all of Mexico is the Anthropological Museum in Central Mexico, Mexico City. We'll spend most of a day there and check out the evidence of ruins and ancient people. Then we're heading to Olmec World, and we'll be there in La Venta, and then Palenque. It's a full tour. We do it every single year. For more information, go to earthancients.com/tours. You got to join us. We're about half full. We only take about 20, 25 people at the most, and it is really, really great fun. We go to locations that allow us to climb the ruins, because you can't stand in front of a ruin and not be able to touch it. And this is what has happened in Yucatan at Chichen Itza. You cannot interact with any of the pyramids. In fact, if they find you sitting in front of them meditating, they'll ask you to get up and move. And that's just not the experience that we want to have. So come out and join us. We'll be interacting with all kinds of pyramids. And it's a real powerful tour, September 2nd through the 12th, 2022. And for more information, go to earthancients.com/tours. All right, that's it for this week's program. I want to thank my guest, Carlton Brown. I wonder if Carlton's still in Guatemala. As always, Ruth Thomas, Mark Foster, and all the team, you guys are amazing. You guys rock. Take care, be well, and we'll talk to you next time.